Hello and welcome to Written in Uncertainty, an Elder Scrolls podcast sat firmly in the grey maybe of the series universe. My name is Arimithius, and today we're discussing some of the most fundamental laws of the Arabis that shape everything from the most powerful of deities and how cultures see themselves, right down to the bedtime stories told to children. Today we're asking, what is mythopoeia, and is Alduin Akatosh? Before we begin, the usual disclaimer, I'd just like to remind everyone that this is my own understanding of the ideas I'm talking about here, and not necessarily the whole truth of the matter, although I'll do my best to bring in other viewpoints as we go through. You may have some other ideas, and if so, I'd absolutely love to hear them. Please leave a comment on the blog post that accompanies this cast at writtenuncertainty.wordpress.com, and also check out the blog, because I'll be linking all the sources that I quote in this podcast there, so please go through and read the sources rather than just taking what I say at face value, and join the conversation at the Written and Uncertainty Discord server. To start with, I'd just like to go over what mythopoeia is in real life. It's kind of a weird word and not one that we encounter too often, so it's probably worth measuring, and it's also not something that's unique to Tamriel. Mythopoeia, which is also called mythopoesis, comes from the Greek, and it means myth-making. It's also a kind of fiction genre, according to some people, where the author is not just telling a story, but building a world as well, with its own myths and legends. Tolkien is the best example here, and he used the term himself when referring to how he thought about Middle-earth. He wasn't just writing the stories, he was building a world full of stories complete with their own myths that the characters reference throughout all the tales that we, as the readers, are actually told about the place. While no other authors explicitly call out what they're doing as mythopoeia, pretty much any act of creating a background for a world that exists outside of the story itself is an act of mythopoeia. You could call the creation of the in-game texts in the Elder Scrolls a mythopoeic endeavour by Bethesda, as it's an attempt to build a series of stories and myths to make a world feel more in-depth and more real. However, it means something a little different in-universe. The key takeaway from the real-world mythopoeia is to remember that it's an act of making myth. When we look for it in the Elder Scrolls itself, it's a fairly obscure word, and it shows up only in one place in the games. In the Elder Scrolls 3 in Morrowind, Yagrim Bagan mentions that Kagranak's tools were created to forge mythopoeic enchantments. We don't hear about it anywhere else. However, Yagrim does go into a little more detail about what precisely mythopoeic enchantment entails. Under the discussion topic of mythopoeic enchantments, we have this quote. In his search for the secrets of immortality, Kagranak sought to control supernatural forces that you might call divine. This artifact, called Wraithguard, was one of the tools that he created for this purpose. Some believed his tampering with such forces was profane and terribly dangerous. You know the Dwemer disappeared? His use of these tools may have been responsible. This gives us a fairly quick definition of what mythopoeic enchantments are, that they are enchantments which control or influence the divine, and so we can extrapolate that mythopoeia and mythopoeic forces in general are those forces which can control or influence the divine. However, actually applying it and working out what those are isn't quite that simple. To start with, we have the Aedra and Daedra in the Elder Scrolls, and they're different classes of divine beings, so are they affected differently by mythopoeic forces? I think so, personally, because we have the book Aedra and Daedra, which states this. Aedra created the mortal world and are bound to the earth bones. Daedra, who cannot create, have the power to change. As part of the divine contract of creation, the Aedra can be killed. Witness Lorcan and the Moons. The Protean Daedra, for whom the rules do not apply, can only be banished. This isn't an outright statement that one group will be affected by mythopoeia and one won't, but it can be taken to imply that only the Aedra can be affected. They're obviously much more susceptible to being manipulated to things and can be killed in this text because of their ties to Mundus. This may also have something to do with the way that the various Aedra and Daedra are perceived. We have this piece of speculation from Fintius in the thread Amulet, Amulet, Who Put Her in the Amulet. And bear in mind, this is fan speculation, so I'll take it how you will, but it puts a pretty good picture on it for me as to how to think about how the Aedra and the Daedra could potentially be affected by Mythopoeia. If you got a theological expert from each of the races of Tamriel, Akavir, Pyandonir, Thras and Adramora in the room and asked them about the nature of Akatosh and Lorcan, they'd argue for days. If you asked them about the nature of Shir Gorath, they'd be able to reach a pretty quick consensus. The Daedra have the advantage of one uber-strong, unified belief. This would affect Creatia far more than many split beliefs like those of the Aedra. Perhaps that's even why the Aedra cannot affect the mortal realm as much as the Daedra. The unified belief, and therefore unified soul, gives Daedra more ability to control Creatia. The Aedra, in the meantime, are weakened by the lack of unified belief. The mythopoeic forces cause the Aedra to split into many separate manifestations, each with only a portion of the capabilities of the original Aedra. Does this then mean that we have a situation where the gods gain strength from worship and belief? It certainly feels that way from that particular quote. It's also a fairly common trope that we have in some fantasy worlds, most well known of which are American Gods and the Discworld. But does it apply to Tamriel? We have a quote from the book An Overview of Gods and Worship, which says this: "It's been theorized that gods do in fact gain strength from such things as worship through praise, sacrifice, and deed. It may even be theorized that the number of worshippers a given deity has may reflect his overall position among the other gods. This is my own conjecture, garnered from the apparent ability of the larger temples to attain blessings and assistance from their god with greater ease than smaller religious institutions." I don't think this is quite it, however, because you would then expect to see gods being shaped and changed as society evolves and new ones springing up and old ones dying out and so on and so forth. We do have some instances of new gods emerging, most notably the creation of the Eight Divines Pantheon, with Akatosh being stripped of his Moorish aspects later on. But these sorts of events don't involve the wholesale shifting of a culture overnight. They involve the actions of a few particular people doing something quite explicitly to a god. So it's not the belief that's powering it, it's not the worship itself. The creation of the Eight Divines in particular wasn't necessarily getting large numbers of people to believe something new. It was a twisting of the old in a different direction. It was a refraction of the belief rather than a total change. Also, I think key to how this is done is, if we think about the meaning of the word mythopoeia, when we think about myths, that this is done through story, which goes back to that original meaning of the word. The made-up word roundup thread from what I think was the original Bethesda forums has a quote by Alaraleraia, I think. I honestly don't know how to pronounce that name, I've tried to get my tongue around it. But the quote itself is this: "As in mythopoeic enchantments, which is what Kagranak was supposedly doing with the tools, would appear to mean shaping reality by means of altering archetypes and myth." The use of archetypes is important here. In Jungian psychology, there's this idea that certain types of character, known as the archetypes, are universal throughout all peoples. These then emerge as literary constructs which will conform to certain patterns, figures like the mother, the child, the warrior, the trickster. And these will, according to the Jungian model, express certain constant patterns of behaviour. If we take this as true, then if we could alter those archetypes through the direct manipulation of myth, through what would in effect be the use of mythopoeic force, going by that definition, then you can do something very powerful. It's not that the things are shaped by belief, but belief adheres to archetypes. You change the archetypes and changing the myth, and you then change the belief and the thing that's believed in. That's what Alicia and the Murakati Selectives, and arguably the Tribunal, were all doing when they set up new gods. I think the Dwemer probably were as well to an extent, but I don't think that they were doing quite the same kind of manipulation as the others that we have here. While the others and the explicit examples that we have were all aiming at specific things, namely things like the creation of the Divine's Pantheon and altering the expression of precisely what Akatosh was. The Dwemer seemed to be aiming to manipulate what the nature of divinity itself was. They wanted to reshape the meaning of godhood and mortality and how those all relate. And they were also doing the typical Moorish thing of manipulating what the gods were to make themselves be that same thing once again, and altering what their actual archetype is in the process. But I think I'm possibly digressing slightly here. But if we go back to the quote that talks about mythopoeia, the base of the word itself, which is myth, derives from the Greek mythos, which is the counterpart for logos, and they're both words for truth. Myths therefore convey truth, or truths, which is probably the more accurate way of putting it. While logos is typically aimed at factual or logical truth, it's where we get the word logical from, mythos is dealing with more subjective truths, truths about the human condition, and things that, while they may not always hold to precisely the case, there's something that will remain the same throughout. And that's what people mean when they talk about the power of myth to speak to people across generations and to remain universally relevant. In order for a myth to be a myth, it has to express some truth about existence. It's not so much literal truth, or it would be a form of logos, it would be a factual account of an event, but truths about underlying human patterns. If we go back to the Elder Scrolls, I personally think that all truth is mythos to some extent in how it's treated on Nern. We have texts like Reality and Other Falsehoods that indicate that the idea of a factual, immovable truth is very unlike what we see in the world of the Elder Scrolls, which is something that Lawrence Schick has also indicated in this specific quote from ESO Live. This is a world of myth. This is a world where reality is actually changeable, where the divines can change not only what happens going forward, but what has happened in the past. So, you know, the idea that there is an objective reality behind all these different people's opinions is not necessarily the case in the world of Tamriel. Given this, shaping myths is shaping truth in the Elder Scrolls. They're pretty much equivalent. So I think it's probably time that we quote Pontius Pilate and ask, what is truth? Truth in the Elder Scrolls has various associations beyond simply being what actually happened, so to speak. As I've said before, the straight truth of anything is something that the Elder Scrolls tries desperately to avoid. They'll be vague about the events of previous games and present alternative viewpoints and that sort of thing. And even where that is done, it's generally quite limited. The truth in sequence is actually the source that talks about truth more than most texts in the Elder Scrolls, and talks mostly about a specific truth, that of Anuic unity and Padomaic falsehood and deception. But even in this text, we have the implication that truth itself is not a categorical definite thing. At one point, the readers get encouraged to quote, "Smash the old machines, topple your mind's idols, and from the wreckage assemble new truths, flawless and watertight." Even here, in a book called The Truth, indicates that there are multiple truths, and that truth is a thing to be manipulated. It's quite an active thing that's going on here. It's taking things and making them true, constructing truths out of materials. It's not a matter of just seeing something and knowing its truth, because the things in themselves aren't the truth. Truth is something that is made and shaped quite actively. This is even more the case if we look at the 36 Lessons of Vivek, where truth is repeatedly associated with blunt force violence. We have this quote from Sermon 31, "Truth is like my husband, instructed to smash, filled with procedure and noise, hammering, weighty, heaviness made schematic, lessons learned only by a mace." And this from Sermon 36, Aeym took from the star its fire, Set took from it its mystery, and Vec took from it its feet, which had been constructed before the gift of Molag Bal, and destroyed in the manner of truth by a great hammering. Alongside these, which do effectively equate truth with violence, truth is often compared with water in the 36 lessons, which the Elder Scrolls Online links with memory. This also winds up being dismissive of objective truth by implication, in that memories are very coloured by subjectivity, and they're not necessarily an accurate record. Truth is what it is made to be by people and their actions. It's not something that is just there. And this is accepted at quite a basic level by some of the students of magic on Tamriel, particularly the School of Alteration. There's actually a book in called Reality and Other Falsehoods, which has this to say about the nature of reality, as it were. To master alteration, first accept that reality is a falsehood. There is no such thing. Our reality is a perception of greater forces impressed upon us for their amusement. Some say that these forces are the gods, others that they are something beyond the gods. For the wizard, it doesn't really matter. What matters is the appeal couched in a manner that cannot be denied. It must be insistent without being insulting. This and all these quotes also mean that there isn't necessarily a single truth behind anything. It may not be a matter of events being perceived from different angles, like the story of the blind man and the elephant, or the idea of looking at a cylinder from different angles to see a rectangle or a circle. We're likely dealing with something that's actually reshaping reality in specific circumstances through the imposition of force against reality, which is kind of like the Thum, which is a very good example of how this works. Arngeir says this about the Thum. There is no difference in the dragon tongue between debating and fighting. Shouting comes as naturally to a dragon as breathing. Dragons use the Thum to impose their will on reality. The debating example is really great. The Thum is then used to say that this is so, which is the point of a debate, generally. It's asserting that your version of events, your reality, so to speak, is the correct one, and you are trying to convince others. To get a little headcanon-y here for a second, I have my own theories about how and why faith and the like work, and it's also tied to myth in the same way. Faith, in the sense that we get presented in Judeo-Christian religions, faith in the sense of being convinced of what we do not see, to quote the Book of Hebrews, doesn't really happen in the Elder Scrolls. The gods can be seen. People are comforted by the obvious ethics of a deity which either manifests directly and spells out right and wrong for them, and if that doesn't suit them, they can always pick another one. We have a fantastic example of this in Sigilla Parate, who makes this abundantly clear in the book Invocation of Azura. They choose a Daedra to worship because it suits them, not because there's any ethical or faith-based problem about any particular deity. Ayala chooses to continue to follow Hircine even after being able to be cured of lycanthropy, for similar reasons, because she enjoys following Hircine and it suits her way of life. However, while faith is almost a lifestyle choice in the Elder Scrolls, that's not quite the end of the story. If we take a look at some of the works of the existentialist philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, he sees these kinds of choices as both fundamental to the human condition and not bounded. He expresses it most well, in my opinion, with the quote, "You are free, therefore choose," that is to say, invent. But the way that those choices are made is not merely preference. It has quite far-reaching subjective and quasi-objective consequences, because it informs our very idea of reality. If we quote Sartre a little further, "To choose between this or that is at the same time to affirm the value of that which is chosen, for we are unable ever to choose the worst." Whatever we choose is always the better, and nothing can be better for us unless it is better for all. If, moreover, existence precedes essence, and we will to exist at the same time as we fashion our image, that image is valid for all and for the entire epoch in which we find ourselves. That is to say, no one acts in the way that they consider would be wrong for anyone. In acting, everyone affirms that their actions are truth, a truth that is both subjective and universal at the same time. Mythopoeia is when it goes a little beyond that, and you impose your truth on others, which you think is true and categorical anyway, by reshaping the archetypes that people are using, and this is how we wind up with different gods in different places for the most part. The archetypes are manipulated and then combined through the retelling and reshaping of myth, which results in several gods being recombined and altered, like Arkay and, according to some people, Trinomach. But the best example of this that we have, or at least the cleanest one, in my view, is Akatosh. And I should probably address the others at some point, but we'll go with the Dragon God for this particular podcast. The Time God is a figure that is a relative constant in Tamrielic mythology. Only the Dunmer, Redguards, and Argonians don't have an easily identifiable cognate of Akatosh in their various pantheons. Some, most particularly Cyrodiilic scholars, equate all aspects of the Time God with Akatosh. We also have the term Akka appearing in some texts, particularly in the Song of Pelennor and the unlicensed Etarda et Aedra eat the Dreamer, which implies a sort of higher order Time God than Akatosh, or whatever name's currently being used. This entity refers to Alderaan as an aspect in the Seven Fights of the Ardu Dagga, which could be seen to imply that we have a single being with many facets. I'm a little sceptical of that, or at least of the idea that it can relate to a cohesive whole. As I've said earlier, what we have in the Elder Scrolls in relation to gods doesn't seem to be a single entity seen from different angles. It's different entities which are functioning on different archetypes. And time in particular has many different archetypes that can be applied to it. And this is most obvious when you think about different periods of time, if you put them most simply as beginning, middle, and end. Real world myths play off this a lot, with the maiden, mother, crone archetypes for female characters, as well as the riddle of the Sphinx, which is what animal has different legs at different points of its life. It's a man because the aging process changes the person. In relation to Akka, we get a concoction that expresses the different time gods as different periods of time. The most common breakdown that you'll see in the community is Auriel as the beginning of time, Akatosh as the middle of time, and Alduin as the end of time. And this plays very nicely into where we see these different entities the most. Auriel has less and less to do with the myths that we hear the further away you get from the Dawn Era, whereas Alduin has always been associated with the end times by the Nords. However, Akatosh puts a spanner in the work here, and that's because of some potentially weird things going on. And I know, you're all shocked, I'm sure. Paradoxes connected to the nature of the Time God? I mean, who could have seen that coming? Akatosh became what he is in the time of the games through the interference of the Murakati Selectives in the First Era. The Selectives caused a dragon break in order to remove some perceived Murish elements from the Time God to take away the stuff they didn't like. You'll see some claim that this is the point that where Akatosh is created, that the actions of the Selectives made Auriel into Akatosh. Where Were You When the Dragon Broke points this out quite explicitly by saying, to quote, "A fanatical sect of the Elysian Order, the Murakati Selective, becomes frustrated by ancient Old Murray traditions still present within the theological system of the Eight Divines. Specifically, they hated any admission that Akatosh, the Supreme Spirit, was indisputably also Auriel, the Elven High God." However, we also have texts like Shazar and the Divines that assert that Akatosh was originally an Old Murray god. If that's the case, why do we have Auriel as the head of most Murish pantheons here? I think the answer lies in what the Selectives did, but more specifically when and how. The Selectives created a Dragon Break in order to meddle with the nature of Akatosh and change him up into what they wanted him to be, which can be seen as a return to the Dawn era before time. That particular Dragon Break is called the Middle Dawn. If that's the case, it's possible that any changes wrought during a Dragon Break could potentially have retroactive effects. So, Akatosh was split from his Mirish aspect in the untime of the Middle Dawn, which could conceivably create two different gods who have both existed for the duration of linear time, but are also frequently confused with each other. I mean, they were originally the same thing. I saw a particular post on this years ago on the old Bethesda forums, which sums it up really nicely. I have no idea who originally posted it. I've tried in vain to find it, but I'm probably mangling the phrasing given that I can't dig it out from search engines. The quote, as I remember it, is this: "Alduin is the son of Akatosh, who has always existed. But Auriel and Alduin were Akatosh before he always existed." If this is true, then what we have is an imperfectly overlaid new version of the Time God, created by the Murakati and superimposed over Auriel, which is now called Akatosh by everyone. Or maybe there was a version called Akatosh that the Murakati just enlarged. We can't really know for sure based on our current knowledge and our position within the Uribis. We can't go back to a time where the Selectives never danced on the tower and never created or changed Akatosh. So to finally get to the original question of the podcast and compare Alduin and Akatosh, we see Alduin as his own being in the Elder Scrolls V in Skyrim, despite claims from some that Alduin and Akatosh are one and the same. Alduin also doesn't have an explicit birth point in the same way that we can potentially point to for Akatosh, and he isn't around much at the beginning of the universe either, despite being the so-called wellspring of the Nordic pantheon in Varieties of Faith. We just don't have the same level of confusion with Akatosh in the same way that we do with Auriel. There's not conflicting accounts, there's just some people saying, yes, they're the same god, others people saying, no, they're not. So, either we have Alduin being associated with the Time God at a lower subgradient, that is that Alduin was Akatosh self-reflecting enough to birth another soul, or there's something else going on. The Seven Fights of the Al-Dudaga and the Eat the Dreamer text both point to there being an Akka above Akatosh, that there's an entity from which both Akatosh and Alduin are derived. Various other of Michael Kirkbride's writings and forum posts also call Alduin Akatosh's mirror brother, rather than a son or a father or any kind of familial relation other than equals almost. The clearest quote on that is this: "Don't forget that gods can be shaped by the mythopoeic forces of the Mantlers, so Tosh-Raka could be an Akaviri avatar of Akatosh with a grudge against his mirror brother in Cyrodiil. Just like Akatosh as we usually know him could time scheme against his mirror brother of the Nords, Alduin, to keep the present Kalpa, perhaps his favourite, from being eaten. Notice all the coulds." All those coulds notwithstanding, this feels like the forces of mythopoeia can potentially break up various parts of the Time Dragon into his component parts. This makes sense if you think about how stories are told about time. Even in common speech, we have time as a healer, a hound that's always at our heels, a relentless force that wipes everything away, and probably a bunch of other metaphors that I can't think of right now. Each of those roles requires different types of stories, different myths and different archetypes in order to be told coherently. So it's pretty much inevitable that a time god, connected as they are to the changeability of the material world, would wind up as a being with several different attributes, or as several different attributes expressed as fundamentally contradictory things. And we also have a potentially adversarial relationship between Akatosh and Alduin, which is hinted at in the above quote, and is also a consequence of so many different tales being told about time. this is more or less spelled out in Etada et Aedra et the Dreamer in this particular quote. The Aedroth Acca, which goes by so many names as to perhaps already suggest what I'm about to commit to Memospor, is completely insane. His mind broke when his perch from eternity allowed the day. That fragmentation would then allow for different aspects of Acca to both exist and be Acca all at once, being extracted from the bigger whole. If we also allow for the possibility that Acca is insane, Akatosh and Alduin can both be the same being and have different drives in line with their various mythic archetypes. The two beings are defined by the mythopoiesis that they're associated with, but are only manipulated and changed when the underlying archetypes are changed. Alduin is therefore the longer lasting in the mythic history of Tamriel, and despite his statements, probably prior to Akatosh in my opinion. In the timelines before the machinations of the Murakati changed the nature of Akatosh. And this is also because we see Alduin as being a much more unitary being. There's not different versions of him in the same way that we have with Akatosh, and so it's entirely likely that he is distinct because of being this much more unitary being, in my opinion. That's about all of my thoughts on this particular topic for now. Thank you ever so much for taking the time to listen, and if you liked this podcast, please consider subscribing on your favourite podcatcher. I'm on most of the ones out there now. And if you fancy a chat, please join the discussion at the Written Uncertainty Discord server. Another note, I'm collating a list of some of the best long-form essays I can find on the Elder Scrolls lore and posting them on my website, just so there's one place where you can go to find all these, regardless of where they were first written. If you have any that you think should be in there, or you know of any, please let me know. I'll be posting a link to the list that I have currently in the blog post alongside this cast. And finally, a note to those listening as these podcasts are coming out. This will be the last episode before Christmas. I will be travelling before the next episode is due to be out, and then away from my recording kit for quite a while. Once I get back, I'll also be looking into using a more convenient host for the podcast, which will hopefully mean that the process of uploading and distributing the podcast is a bit less manual than the one that I've been using up to this point. This may mean that there's some downtime or glitches while I'm transferring things over, if you're trying to listen to things while I'm doing that. I hope not, but this is a heads up just in case. And in the meantime, I hope you all have a fantastic holiday season, and I will be back with some more episodes in the new year. Until then, this podcast remains a letter written in uncertainty. You've been listening to Written in Uncertainty, a podcast written and presented by Aramithius. The music for this podcast has been kindly provided by Jan Glembotsky. Check them out on SoundCloud under Songs from the Lost Land, and I'll see you next time.